This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will be a question session reviewing multiple choice questions related to tibial plateau fractures and physeal considerations, which are two topics that we covered this past week on the podcast. So let's get right into it. We'll start with tibial plateau fractures, and the first question reads, which of the following concerning meniscus tears in tibial plateau fractures is true? And the choices are 1, lateral meniscus tears are most common and occur with Schatzker II fractures. Open evaluation with division of the meniscotibial ligaments is recommended. 2, lateral meniscus tears are most common and occur with Schatzker III fractures, and open evaluation with division of the meniscofemoral ligaments is recommended. 3, lateral meniscus tears are most common and occur with Schatzker I fractures, and open evaluation with division of the meniscotibial ligaments is recommended. 4, medial meniscus tears are most common and occur with Schatzker II fractures, and open evaluation with division of the meniscotibial ligaments is recommended. And 5, lateral meniscus tears are most common and occur with Schatzker II fractures, and arthroscopic evaluation at the time of internal fixation is recommended. So lateral meniscus tears occur most commonly in young males with a lateral split depression tibial plateau fracture. In these cases, a submeniscal arthrotomy with direct meniscal evaluation should be performed to evaluate necessity for repair. So the correct answer to this question is 1. Lateral meniscus tears are most common and occur with Schatzker II fractures, and open evaluation with division of the meniscotibial ligaments is recommended. These tears occur most frequently in young males, with peripheral rim tears most commonly associated with split depression fractures. Surgical treatment of the meniscal tear occurs after fracture is reduced and fixation complete with an anterolateral approach. The joint is then exposed and the meniscus evaluated. For longitudinal tears, meniscal repair should be performed. Radial tears can be partially resected, but in rare cases, these can be repaired as well. Ruiz Ilban et al. Performed a study to determine the results of repair of meniscus tears found during arthroscopically assisted reduction and internal fixation of tibial plateau fractures. In a cohort of 51 tibial plateau fractures treated with arthroscopically assisted reduction and internal fixation, 15 associated meniscal tears in 15 knees in 14 patients were repaired. A second-look arthroscopy was performed in 13 knees at a mean of 14.2 months after the initial surgery. All patients had good or excellent clinical results. Second-look arthroscopy confirmed complete healing in 92% of meniscal tears when performed. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following is the most significant risk factor for lateral meniscus tears associated with lateral tibial plateau fractures? And the choices are 1, age greater than 50, 2, female sex, 3, ipsilateral calcaneus fracture, 4, greater than 10 millimeters of articular depression, and 5, Schatzker I fracture pattern. So significant depression of a lateral tibial plateau fracture has been shown to be associated with an increased risk of lateral meniscal tears. Concomitant meniscal injury and tibial plateau fractures are well reported, with the incidence upon surgical evaluation noted to be approximately 30%. The incidence of lateral meniscal tears on MRI evaluation of tibial plateau injuries is notably higher, however, and has been reported as high as 91%. Of note, collateral or cruciate ligament rupture has also been reported with tibial plateau fractures, with the incidence greater than 75% on an MRI evaluation. Ringus et al. Reviewed 85 patients with tibial plateau fractures and found that 32.9% of lateral plateau fractures had associated lateral meniscus tears. Depression greater than 10 millimeters led to an 8-fold risk increase, while patients under 48 years old had a 4-fold risk increase. Stahl et al. Reviewed 602 patients with a tibial plateau fracture and noted a 30% overall concomitant meniscal tear incidence. These tears occurred more frequently in young males, with peripheral rim tears most commonly associated with split depression fractures. So the correct answer to this question is 4, the most significant risk factor for lateral meniscal tears associated with lateral tibial plateau fractures is in injuries that have greater than 10 millimeters of articular depression. Moving on to the next question. Which soft tissue structure is most commonly injured in Schatzker II tibial plateau fractures? And the choices are 1, medial meniscus, 2, lateral meniscus, 3, medial collateral ligament, 4, lateral collateral ligament, and 5, anterior cruciate ligament. So lateral meniscal tears are most commonly associated with Schatzker II tibial plateau fractures, which are characterized as split/depressed fractures. The majority of meniscal injuries that occur in the setting of tibial plateau fractures are meniscocapsular detachments. Lateral meniscal tears are most commonly associated with Schatzker II tibial plateau fractures. The literature suggests that lateral meniscal injuries are more prominent in fractures involving at least 6 millimeters of depression and 5 millimeters of widening. ACL injuries are more common in type 5 and type 6 fractures. It is generally agreed upon that meniscal tears should be repaired, if possible, at the time of internal fixation to decrease the likelihood of post-traumatic arthritis, whereas ACL injuries can be repaired acutely or in a delayed fashion. So the correct answer to this question asking which soft tissue structure is most commonly injured in Schatzker II tibial plateau fractures, the answer is 2, lateral meniscus. Gardner et al. Reviewed 62 patients with Schatzker II tibial plateau fractures that happened to have an MRI preoperatively. After reviewing the scan, the most common associated injury with displaced fractures was lateral meniscus tears in 83% of the patients studied. Other injuries included lateral collateral ligament tears and posterior cruciate ligament injuries in approximately 30% of the patients. Gardner also reviewed 103 patients with tibial plateau fractures, and the overall incidence of injury to soft tissues was higher than previously reported. Only one patient in the series had complete absence of any soft tissue injury. 79 patients, or 77% of the patients studied, sustained a complete tear or avulsion of one or more cruciate or collateral ligaments. 94 patients, or 91% of the patients studied, had evidence of lateral meniscus pathology. Moving on to the next question. A 45-year-old man was skiing when he sustained a direct blow to the lateral side of his left knee. Radiographs reveal a left split depression tibial plateau fracture. What is the best method of treatment for this articular injury? And the choices are 1, open reduction and internal fixation with absolute stability. 2, open reduction and internal fixation with relative stability. 3, closed reduction with casting. 4, reamed locked intramedullary nailing. And 5, external fixation. So basic understanding of fracture care requires a fundamental knowledge of the principles regarding absolute and relative stability. Compression plating and anatomic reduction of articular fractures are examples of absolute stability. Bridge plating, external fixation, casting, and intramedullary nailing are all examples of relative stability. Both bone and forearm fractures have long been treated with open reduction and internal fixation, even in the light of open wounds. Results have been excellent with plate fixation. Recently, intramedullary nails that are contoured and locked have been used in the treatment of both bone and forearm fractures, but they are not reamed. It is well established that with restoring the proper radial bow, length and alignment, optimal function can be achieved. Open reduction and internal fixation allows this achievement. In cases where comminution exists, absolute stability may have to be sacrificed so as to not strip small comminuted bone fragments. Therefore, a bridging technique is worthwhile. External fixation can be used as a temporary technique until the soft tissues are more amenable to definitive fixation. Cast treatment is not indicated in adult forearm fractures. Locking nails for forearm use are not reamed. With regards to articular fractures, anatomic reduction and rigid stabilization are required to achieve the best results and allow for fracture healing, and this environment also allows for the best chance of the cartilage repair process to form hyaline-like cartilage. So the correct answer to this question asking what is the best method of treatment for an articular injury in a tibial plateau fracture, the correct answer is 1, open reduction and internal fixation with absolute stability. Open reduction and internal fixation with absolute stability is the mainstay of treatment for partial articular fractures such as split depression tibial plateau fractures and posterior malleolus fractures involving greater than about 25 to 30% of the joint. The gold standard for the treatment of a closed femur fracture is a reamed intramedullary locked nail. Results are uniformly excellent. This can be done without stripping of the soft tissues such as in open reduction and internal fixation. External fixation can be used as a temporary device in patients in extremis for damage control reasons. Moving on to the next question. A 63-year-old woman with osteopenia is struck by a motor vehicle and sustains a Schatzker II fracture of the lateral tibial plateau. She has 1.5 centimeters of joint depression and 7 millimeters of condylar widening. What is the most appropriate surgical fixation for this injury? And the choices are 1, lateral non-locking construct, 2, percutaneous screws, 3, external fixation, 4, lateral locking construct, and 5, medial and lateral plating. So the patient has a significantly displaced partial articular fracture of the tibial plateau. Surgical treatment is preferred in an effort to restore the axis of the knee, achieve an articular reduction, and allow for repair of commonly associated soft tissue injuries, such as meniscal tears. This requires direct reduction, and fixation should provide subarticular support, interfragmentary compression, and buttress. This is best achieved with an undercontoured lateral non-locking plate. So the correct answer to this question is 1, lateral non-locking construct. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following tibial plateau fracture patterns is most likely to benefit from a temporary spanning external fixator? And the choices are 1, Schatzker 1 with minimal displacement, 2, Schatzker 2 with significant depression, 3, Schatzker 3 with an associated meniscal tear, 4, Schatzker 4 with minimal displacement, and 5, Schatzker 6 with shortening. So spanning external fixation for proximal tibial plateau fractures is indicated for fracture patterns that are axially unstable and for those that have associated unstable knee subluxation / dislocation. Schatzker types 1, 2, and 3 are unicondylar fractures where the medial side remains intact. These are axially stable fracture patterns that do not benefit significantly from temporary spanning external fixation. Schatzker type 4 fractures are isolated medial plateau fractures where the lateral side remains intact and are also axially stable and do not benefit significantly from spanning external fixation. However, Schatzker type 4 fractures are often associated with subluxation / dislocation. In these fractures, the medial side is usually widely displaced and the femur is moving with the medial side, leaving the lateral tibial plateau subluxated laterally. These fractures would benefit from spanning external fixation. So the correct answer to this question is 5, Schatzker 6 with shortening. Schatzker type 6 fractures are usually high-energy fractures. They are bicondylar and axially unstable and often benefit from temporary spanning external fixation. Once the soft tissue envelope has recovered, definitive fixation can follow with removal of the spanning external fixator. Moving on to the next question. Patient outcome after open reduction and internal fixation of tibial plateau fractures shows that patients older than 50 years of age, when compared to younger patients, have, and the choices are 1, equal results for all fracture types, 2, better outcomes in high-energy fractures, 3, better outcomes in low-energy fractures, 4, a higher wound complication rate, and 5, worse outcomes in low-energy fractures. So several studies have shown worse functional results in patients older than 40 or 50 years of age compared to younger patients after open reduction and internal fixation of tibial plateau fractures. 2 studies showed that older patients with less severe fractures performed less favorably than younger patients with more severe injuries. Only 35% of patients older than 50 years were satisfied with their results independent of fracture type. So the correct answer to this question is 5, worse outcomes in low-energy fractures. Moving on to the next question. Locked lateral plate fixation of the proximal tibia is most appropriate for what Schatzker type fracture? And the choices are 1, lateral plateau split, 2, lateral plateau split / depression, 3, lateral plateau depression, 4, medial plateau fracture, and 5, bicondylar tibial plateau fracture. So locked lateral plate fixation of the proximal tibia has proven effective for bicondylar fractures, that is Schatzker's types 5 and 6. The laterally based plate provides support for the lateral condyle fracture, and locked proximal screws support the medial fragment from varus collapse. A medial anti-glide plate can be used in conjunction with the locked plate. Lateral locked plate fixation has not been shown to have advantages for pure lateral fractures, that is Schatzker types 1, 2, and 3, that require buttress plating or support of depressed articular components. Pure medial fractures, that is Schatzker type 4, are best treated with medial fixation. But the correct answer to this question is 5, bicondylar tibial plateau fractures are most appropriate for a locked lateral plate fixation. Moving on to the next question. In an uninjured proximal tibia, which statement best describes the shape and position of the medial tibial plateau relative to the lateral tibial plateau? And the choices are 1, more concave and more proximal, 2, more convex and more proximal, 3, more concave and more distal, 4, more convex and more distal. And 5, symmetric in contour and more distal. So the medial tibial plateau is more concave and more distal relative to the lateral tibial plateau. Watson et al. Report, quote, the medial tibial plateau has a more concave shape and is larger in both length and width than the lateral tibial plateau, which has a slightly convex shape. The lateral tibial plateau lies proximal to the medial plateau. The convexity of the lateral plateau helps differentiate it from the medial plateau on a lateral radiograph of the proximal tibia. So the correct answer to this question, asking the shape and position of the medial tibial plateau relative to the lateral tibial plateau, the correct answer is 3. It is more concave and more distal. Moving on to the next question. In treating a lateral split depression type tibial plateau fracture, which of the following adjuncts has been shown to have the least articular surface subsidence when used to fill the bony void? And the choices are 1, crushed cancellous allograft, 2, hydroxyapatite, 3, calcium phosphate cement, 4, autogenous iliac crest, and 5, bisected diaphyseal humeral allograft. So in treating tibial plateau fractures, calcium phosphate has been shown to have the least amount of articular subsidence on follow-up examinations. The study by Russell et al. Noted a significantly increased rate of subsidence at 12 months with autograft as compared to calcium phosphate cement in Schatzker types 1 through 6. In another study by Lobenhofer et al., they noted improved radiographic outcomes and earlier weight bearing with usage of calcium phosphate cement. So the correct answer to this question is 3, calcium phosphate cement. And moving on to the final question for this topic, lipohemarthrosis of the knee is most likely secondary to which of the following? And the choices are 1, seronegative monoarticular arthritis, 2, patellar tendon rupture, 3, medial meniscus tear, 4, medial patellofemoral ligament rupture, and 5, occult fracture. So lipohemarthrosis is formed when an intraarticular fracture occurs and can be detected with arthrocentesis or imaging such as an X-ray, MRI, ultrasound, or CT. It is most commonly seen with occult tibial plateau fractures but can be associated with any intraarticular fractures. Up to 3 layers are visible on an MRI, that is fat, serum, and cellular parts of blood, and this separation may take up to 3 hours to appear after injury. The article by An et al. Is a review of MRI findings in intraarticular knee injuries. They note that detection of lipohemarthrosis on an MRI is very sensitive and specific for intraarticular fracture. The article by Schick et al. Reports that MRI can be as sensitive as arthrocentesis in detecting lipohemarthrosis for an occult fracture. So the correct answer to this question asking what lipohemarthrosis of the knee is most likely secondary to, and the answer is 5, occult fracture. Moving on to the final topic of physical considerations, the first question reads, children develop hand dominance by approximately what age? And the choices are 1, 6 months to 9 months, 2, 12 months to 18 months, 3, 2 years to 3 years, and 4, 4 years to 5 years. So most children develop hand dominance during their third year. Although there is individual variation in age of development of handedness, infants and toddlers are normally ambidextrous. Strong hand preference in a child younger than age 2 may indicate a neurological deficit. Persistence of ambidexterity is not pathological. But the correct answer to this question asking what age children develop hand dominance by, the correct answer is 2 to 3 years old. Moving on to the next question. A 5-year-old boy sustains a Salter-Harris type 2 fracture of the distal femur. 1 year later, he is noted to have radiographic evidence of injury. Injury to the physis occurred through which cellular layer? And the choices are 1, resting, 2, proliferative, 3, maturation, 4, lower hypertrophic. So most physeal fracture separations occur at the zone of hypertrophy or at the chondroosseous junction. In Salter-Harris types 3 and 4 fractures, the resting, proliferative, and upper hypertrophic zones are sometimes involved. But the correct answer to this question is 4, lower hypertrophic zone. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following regions in the growth plate is commonly affected in a Salter-Harris type 2 injury? And the choices are 1, reserve zone, 2, proliferative zone, 3, hypertrophic zone, 4, zone of provisional calcification, and 5, primary spongiosa. So a type 2 injury consists of fracture along the growth plate with an attached bony fragment. The metaphyseal fragment is located on the compressive or concave side, whereas periosteum is torn on the tensile or convex side. The reserve and proliferative zones remain with the epiphysis, and the circulation is usually preserved. The hypertrophic zone is the weakest zone in tension and is most frequently fractured. So the correct answer to this question is 3, the hypertrophic zone. Moving on to the next question. Post-traumatic physeal arrest is most common at which of the following locations? And the choices are 1, proximal tibia, 2, proximal humerus, 3, distal radius, 4, distal humerus, and 5, distal tibia. So post-traumatic physeal arrest occurs most commonly in the distal medial tibia. Using MRI, Eklund and associates confirmed this finding. Arrest of the distal radius and proximal humerus are rare after trauma. Traumatic injuries of the distal femoral and distal ulnar physis have a high incidence of growth arrest as well. So the correct answer to this question is 5, distal tibia. Moving on to the next question. Traumatic physeal growth arrest in which of the following locations will create the greatest limb length discrepancy in a 12-year-old male? And the choices are 1, distal humerus, 2, distal radius, 3, distal femur, 4, proximal tibia, and 5, proximal femur. So the distal femoral physis has the greatest annual contribution to limb length with an average of 9 to 10 millimeters of growth per year. So the correct answer to this question is 3, distal femur. Injury to the reserve or proliferative zones of the physis are most likely to result in permanent damage to the physis. Growth at the physis continues until skeletal maturity, which may be assumed at chronological age, 14 years in girls and 16 years in boys. Growth arrest at 12 years old in a male assumes 4 years of remaining growth. Therefore, expected limb length discrepancy can be calculated as 4 by 10 millimeters or 40 millimeters of limb length discrepancy. Abzug et al. Reviewed physeal arrest of the distal radius. They state that after physeal injury, repeat radiographs are recommended every 3 months to ensure normal growth resumes. This is often demonstrated by parallel Park-Harris lines through the metaphysis of the distal radius. Moving on to the next question. Growth at the distal humerus physis accounts for what percentage of humeral growth? And the choices are 1, 20%, 2, 40%, 3, 50%, 4, 60%, and 5, 80%. So in a review of 200 radiographs, Pritchett found that approximately 80% of growth in the humerus bone occurred from the proximal humerus. Therefore, the distal humerus is responsible for the remaining 20% of growth. So the correct answer to this question is 1, 20%. Remembering the specific contributions to length from each physis can be cumbersome. It may be helpful to recall that growth primarily occurs at the knee in the lower extremity and away from the elbow in the upper extremity. And moving on to the final question for this review session, premature arrest following growth plate injury is attributed to what mechanism? And the choices are 1, proliferation of the perichondrial ring of LaCroix, 2, initiation of Wolf's Law, 3, disruption of the Hooter-Volkmann principle, and 4, vascular invasion across the physis. So Salter-Harris types 3 and 4 fractures create disruption through all physeal zones. A conduit for invasion of blood vessels not normally present between the metaphysis and epiphysis creates the potential for influx of osteoblasts and formation of a bony bar that prevents further longitudinal growth. So the correct answer to this question is 4, premature arrest following growth plate injury is attributed to vascular invasion across the physis. The remaining responses do not contribute to traumatic physeal arrest. The perichondrial ring of LaCroix is a fibrocartilaginous periosteal ring surrounding the physis that provides up to 50% of resistance to shear stress. According to Wolf's Law, bone deposition and resorption occurs in response to the stresses placed upon it. The Hooter-Volkmann principle describes slowing of longitudinal physeal growth in response to increasing compressive force. The hypertrophic zone demonstrates a decrease in cell size and columnar density as physeal closure approaches. That's all for this review session about tibial plateau fractures and physeal considerations. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.